Hey, before we get started, I wanted to mention the Hollywood Support Staff Relief Fund, started by PayUp Hollywood co-founder and the keeper of the WGA Solidarity Grid, Liz Alper, and supported with pledges by John August, Craig Mazin, Greg Berlanti, Shonda Rhimes, Damon Lindelof, Lena Dunham, and a ton of other industry folks. They've raised over $500,000 in just over a week to provide financial support to industry assistants who are out of work due to the coronavirus outbreak. If you'd like to make a donation, or if you are one of the Hollywood staffers affected and could use the financial support, go to @LizAlps on Twitter for more info, and we'll also be sure to post the links. So be sure to check it out if you need help or can help. And if you see Liz in person, be sure to give her a high five and buy her a drink. She certainly deserves it. She's awesome. Thanks, and on to the show. Good morning, good day, or good evening, whenever and wherever you are listening. My name is Kevin Fukunaga, and you've joined the Scripts and Scribes Social. Many of us are socially distancing ourselves, so this is our opportunity to hear from other writers who are going through the same experience. Today, we've got on a pair of writers. The first is a TV writer, producer, and director, best known for his work on Boy Meets World, Girl Meets World, and Ghostwriter, now streaming on Apple TV Plus, Mark Blutman. And also joining us is veteran sports reporter who is working on a sports screenplay of his own, and he's worked for CBS Sports, The Sporting News, Pro Football Daily, and he's ESPN's Redskins Insider and has been a contributor on SportsCenter, Outside the Lines, and ESPN Radio. He is John Keim. Thanks for coming on, Mark and John.
Hey, thanks for having me. Absolutely. It's a pleasure to do your show again, Kevin. I had such a good time the first time, and thanks for having me back.
Yeah, no, I reached out because obviously, as I mentioned before, I think you're a great storyteller, both on and off the page. So it's always a blast chatting with you. And yeah, Mark obviously is a veteran, well-known sports reporter who's venturing into screenwriting, which I think is super interesting. So we'd love, it's going to be a lot of fun chatting with both of you. First off, though, before we get into all the screenwriting chat and the talk about sports and sports movies, which I want to get into, I want to know how you guys are handling the quarantine. How are you able to, work, and how are you able to get work done in this situation? Maybe I'll start with you first, Mark, and then John.
Well, I'm on location in Connecticut right now, and I've been working on a project for the last few months that not quite allowed to talk about publicly, but we are quarantined as well, or self-isolation, however you want to put it. So I'm in a condo and doing all my work via Skype or Zoom or all these other platforms. It's really difficult. Today, it's about day 8 or 9, roughly, that I've been doing this. Mm-hmm. And today, I actually, and this is the truth, I opened a jar of peanut butter. I opened a jar of jelly. I stuck the fork in the peanut butter and then took a big old scoop and put it in the jelly. Took a picture, of course, for Twitter because, you know, people need to know what it's come to. And I ate it, and that was my lunch.
Nice.
Protein and fruit, prepped in about 5 seconds. It's hard because everything is closed. You know, there's really nothing open. You could do a little takeout. But at the end of the day, and I'm sure John feels the same way, we're still blessed. We have health surrounding us and our families. We have not been directly hit by the virus. And so we're just, you know, making do. And listen, being stuck in a house with internet is not the worst thing in the world. Now, had this happened 10 years ago, I'd be going crazy.
Right. And John, how's it going with you? Are you in Virginia?
Yeah, I am in Virginia, and we're in a very rural part of Virginia. So, you know, it's my wife and I and my youngest son are in a house, and we have plenty of elbow room outside. We're in the country, so the daily life isn't all that different. You can go outside. We can walk the dog for 2 miles and not pass anybody. I can go on bike rides if I'm able to. But the overall work structure for me is exact same as it would have been a year ago or any other year at this time, because for ESPN, my job is covering the Redskins. Well, this is free agency, the off season, it's the height of it. So all I'm doing at this time of the year anyways is being holed up in my office, making phone calls, texting agents, players, coaches to find out any news that's going on with the Redskins, and whatever happens, then I then have to react to it. So I'm not getting out and going around at this time of the year anyway. Where you notice it is when you take a break and then you check social media to look for any nugget of hope for the next few weeks, or when you hear, you know, X, Y, and Z are canceled now in May or whatever. But my daily life is pretty much the same as it would have been otherwise.
Mm-hmm. And so far.
I sold a roll of toilet paper for $500.
Wait, did you say?
And that check is coming. And my check is coming. So
that's funny.
I'll count on it, John.
I've heard of takeout places actually including a roll of toilet paper with every takeout order over like $20 or $25. I've seen.
Boy, they don't think very highly of their food.
That to bribe people with toilet paper.
I'm still sharp, Kevin.
That's good. That's good. So yeah, I hope you guys are stocked up with toilet paper. That's good to hear that you guys are getting by okay so far.
You know, it's certainly a very, you know, different time and a scary time, but you know, at the same time, it gives us all a chance to reassess our own lives, our priorities, the things that are important to us. And, you know, it's not so much what is happening right now, as horrific as it is. It's going to be how we come out of it, how we handle it after. And, you know, it's interesting. I'm a little late to this party for whatever reason. I had not seen Jojo Rabbit.
Oh, yeah.
Until yesterday.
And
there was such a parallel in that movie to what we're, you know, to what we're experiencing. And I'm not comparing it to, you know, the Holocaust in any way, but it's about the human spirit. And ultimately, you know, the final line in that little 4-line poem at the end is no feeling is final.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the spirit that little Jojo showed Elsa, you know, almost like metaphorically, Elsa is all of us right now. We're all hiding in, you know, our homes and unsure of when we can come out and what it's going to be like when we come out, and will the sun shine on us when we do come out?
Right. I wanted to ask you, Mark, and then I've got a question for John that's sort of not, that's sports related, because I'm very interested actually. But Mark, I wanted to ask you, as a veteran of the industry, what do you see happening? I mean, how do you see the return to quote unquote normalcy, return to business sort of transpiring? If you've thought about it.
You know, Kevin, it's such a tough question, because we're also faced with a potential strike anyway.
Right.
You know, the NBA agreement, mm-hmm. The negotiation that had begun prior to this, obviously now everything is on hold. So I do believe there will be new deadlines. But let's say everything was good with the Writers Guild and the NBA agreement. And then I think this would eventually return to normal, and productions would start up, and there would maybe be some more aggressive buying, just, you know, because they're really not buying a lot now. So inventory at the studios and networks is probably a little low right now in terms of content. But I think ultimately things would get back to normal. Now, if there is a strike, they obviously, because they are lower on content now and have not, you know, been able to pre-buy prior to a pending strike as they normally would. You may see a lot more reality television. You may see, you know, a lot more reruns, a lot more going into the vault, into the library of old stuff, and, you know, maybe airing some content from, you know, 5, 10, 20 years ago even. So it's hard to really answer definitively, but if this continues for a while and there is ultimately a strike on the other end, then it's anybody's guess what we could see. Just short of one of the networks rerunning Hello, Larry. I don't think it'll come to that. But there's a reference for everybody out there to go Google. Hello, Larry with McLean Stevenson. But Alf, I would be happy if Alf. If they showed Alf as an example, I'd be happy.
Did you say Alf?
Alf.
Yeah.
Alien life form. He was a fuzzy puppet. John, you got to remember Alf, right?
Oh, I absolutely. And I remember Hello, Larry, too. So, yeah.
There you go.
And John, being our resident NFL and sports expert, same question, but about, and this is really more for me, I think, and Mark than necessarily our, all of our listeners, although I'm sure there are sports fans out there. What's going on with the NFL season? I mean, I know that it's the off season now, so I mean, they can still do business, but if this sort of drags on into summer, into training camps and that kind of thing. And I mean, does it affect the off-season business? Things have happened with trades and you know, stuff going on, but I mean.
Right. Well, here's the next big thing coming up is the NFL draft at mm-hmm. the end of April. That's still going to be held. What is different with that is that they've been holding it in, they're holding it in public places. So it's supposed to be in Las Vegas,
right?
And a big public spectacle. Well, now you're obviously not going to have a public spectacle, but you can still hold it. Teams can be at their facilities instead of there, just calling it in, et cetera. It'll be kind of like how it used to be, maybe back in like the 70s or early 80s.
Right.
So they'll still have that. Then the next day, what also starts to happen in a couple of weeks are players start to come back for off-season workouts. That's not going to happen. Then in May, you have what's called organized team activities. Those are basically more official voluntary spring workouts. You can almost bet that those aren't going to happen. And they have mini camps in early June. I would have to put those in jeopardy. So I don't know what's going to happen because they come back for training camp at the end of July. So the fear in talking to people is what happens if you lose all those off-season workouts. You can't just have guys show up in late July for being ready to go for the season. You need some sort of period where they can get back into some level of shape if they're not doing it on their own. You don't want to go there and risk injury. So there are a lot of off-season things that are at risk here in terms of preparation for the season. But like you said, as opposed to other sports, there's at least a possibility of the season not being affected. I don't know if we can even go there with any true optimism or not yet, but you kind of want to cling to that belief because it would mean that life is getting back to normal. But the off-season stuff is vital. And I'll give you a reason why it's vital for, you know, people might wonder why is it so important. Well, if you have a new, like I cover the Washington Redskins, and Mark knows one guy I'm going to talk about very well, but the first one is the head coach, Ron Rivera, mm-hmm. is a new coach of the Redskins. So he's got to go, you know, when you have a new coach, you have a new offense, a new defensive system. Players have to learn that. This impacts their ability to learn their system. They can't implement it until maybe training camp, whereas everybody else, may, you know, if you have an experienced coach who's been at the same place, they already know the offense, the defense, or in a typical year, you're starting to learn it in April. Then if you have a young quarterback, and the Redskins have that, and Dwayne Haskins, he's having to learn a second offense in only his second year in the NFL. So it impacts his ability to be on the field, not just learning the offense, but then putting it into practice. So it's just going to force teams to be creative to try and catch up when the time comes that they do come back.
And John, correct me if I'm wrong, but what about all the kids coming out of college who are
that's
not
enough,
coming,
yes.
those first and second round draft choices, forget them. What about those other kids that can't now fly for interviews and all that?
Well, and then that's a great point. So they always have, during this period leading up to the draft, the pro days, the pro day workouts. So all these college players, each team is allowed to bring in 30 college players for a visit. Well, you obviously can't do that now, so they have to do those on the phone. Then then typically players will have pro days at their college where they can work out one more time for teams. Well, you lose that ability too. And where that really hurts is it's really just one step of a, let's say, a 10-part process. It's one more box to check off. So if you're a really well-known player, chances are teams know a lot about you already. They've already probably met with you, et cetera. But where it really hurts are the guys who are kind of like the underdog stories. So I'm actually writing a story for ESPN on a handful of guys who maybe are from smaller schools who rely on those pro day workouts to get to really impress people. And I'll give you an example. There's a guy, Austin Eckler, who just signed a big deal with the Los Angeles Chargers a couple weeks ago. Well, he's a guy who I think it was like 3 or 4 years ago was at a pro day where he was a Division II player. He was at a pro day for Division I players. So the Division II guys were kind of an afterthought there. And, guys knew of him, but what they would look at is, okay, you're playing Division II. How good can you be? There must be something wrong with him. He must not be athletic. He must not be fast. Well, at this pro day, a bunch of scouts started to leave. Well, the first thing they did is they had everybody do a vertical jump. His vertical jump was like 41 inches, 41 and a half, he told me.
Wow.
So that immediately opens the scouts' eyes. They say, oh, boy, maybe he is athletic. Why? And then they see him run. Oh, wow, he is fast. Now he wasn't drafted, but he had more teams interested in him, which then helped strengthen his bid to land with the team. He just signed a deal where he's now making millions of dollars. So those are the kind of things that get lost in this. So there are little stories that I think, the big name guys, they're going to be okay. Some of the smaller guys may have a harder time getting noticed.
Right. And I don't know about I've heard about the collective bargaining agreement between the league and the Players Association and decreasing the preseason to 3 games instead of 4 and the regular season to 17 games instead of 16. So you're losing part of that preseason. Does that take effect this season or is it?
No, that won't take effect. They're not sure which year that'll take effect yet, but it will not affect this year. Yes. And that's another good point though, because it would have been this summer, they are going to need every minute of practice time for these guys to be on the field, to get to learn the offense, to get to know, for the coaches to evaluate them, et cetera. So, yeah, but that's not until the future.
Right.
And the truth is, until this shakes out, if it goes on, for another 2-3 months, the NFL could very well end up having a 14-game season.
Oh, yeah.
We don't there's every business, in every field is so up in the air right now. But again, compared to, what the hospitals and the healthcare sector is dealing with, this is just sports and it is big business. It is a healthy distraction for people, but happens.
Yeah. And I think in talking to, I was just bringing up the pro day, the small school pro day guys. I was talking to one of those guys the other day, and that was his point. He's like, this is just what everybody's having to deal with. There's some disruption to everybody's lives. This is theirs.
Right.
Now, I know in terms of certain cities like New York and Los Angeles, about the only essential businesses being sort of allowed to continue on. Obviously, teleworking and other things are going on in numerous other fields. But is that something that NFL teams are doing? Are they still going into facilities? Or are most people telecommuting, so to speak? How is that working for a lot of these franchises? Because there's hundreds of people, obviously, right?
Right. It's a split. Almost every employee is working from home now. And but some of the key decision makers might be going into the office. And I know, I was talking to a coach a couple of days ago who is in his home office and he's trying to get ready for the draft. And he's having his kids who are very young come into the office and kind of like they're daddy's home. They don't understand the difference. And then I know, like, for the Redskins facility, they had to shut it. They pretty much, everybody was sent home. In every facility, they're sent home. But every so often, they're basically spraying the building inside to kill any potential viruses. So they are taking steps for those who are still going there. But yeah, I'm guessing it's just maybe two or three guys who are in the facility at all.
Gotcha. And Kevin, I know a big part of your audience are young writers, and I'd be remiss if I, you know, didn't say that if you're in the right frame of mind, again, writing is one of the only jobs out there that you can do round the clock without getting paid for it. So I would use this time to write that project, write that movie, write that TV show that you've been, you know, complaining that you haven't had the time. Listen, man, put in the work, you know, come out of this with a good piece of material. That is, if you're feeling, if you're not, you know, anxious and, you know, not really yourself, then there's no point writing. But if you have periods of, you know, calm, then write and something fabulous.
And to piggyback on that, Mark, too, like I tell my kids, you know, with every situation, there's an opportunity. And I don't mean that like you need to profit off it, but you have to try and spin it so something positive can result for you, because right. It is a brutal time, and everybody's going to be in a situation where they're going to be pinched by something. But how do you emerge from this? Can you come out somehow stronger than before? And it could be just by doing that. And the other thing is, it provides you a distraction. I can tell you from my, you know, I'm sure with you, like working and covering free agency during this period has been a great distraction for me. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise you're just sitting around focused on things, and it's like you're refreshing social media to look to see if Fauci say anything today that gives us optimism, you know? And so it's really being able to pour yourself into that difficult. Now I have to do it because I'm getting paid to do that now. And it's hard to do that if it's not, but if you can somehow focus on that, it can be an opportunity for you to come out of this with something you can say, well, this was terrible, but I produced this, yeah. You know? And so you can at least, you know, focus energy and whatever into that and come out in a better spot.
To what John's saying, Kevin, it's a great indicator of your character. If you're productive now, you're productive always.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And as a working sports reporter and writer of working on your own project, meaning outside of your work for ESPN
right.
and stuff, your own sports screenplay, how are you able to do that? Are you doing that? Is that going to be your King Lear, as everyone is joking about, you know, when you're locked up?
Well, right. It's I will say, like, right now it's been difficult to, like, I was working on it a few weeks ago, and then once this free agency period starts, it's really difficult because the minute you get up, you really are focusing on work. And my day really doesn't end during this period where you can be on call at whatever time. I could get a text at 9 o'clock at night, and it's like, okay, you got to go write a story, or you have to shoot a video to put on ESPN.com. So this period, I kind of took about a week and a half hiatus. But what I do during this period to stay sharp is, and I talked to Mark about this a couple weeks ago about this. I talked to my son, who's breaking into acting into this industry, about just some aspects of it. And maybe you read some things about, you know, like, okay, when I get back to this, you know, what are some tips I can pick up reading this? Or you're always thinking about this. So like, if I'm smoking ribs the other day, which I was doing outside, so I'm like, during that time, talking to my son, and then I'm thinking, okay, what is it that when I'm able to get back to this and give you that discipline in the morning to work on it, what is it that you want to attack now? And so I think it, you know, so while I may not be writing, I'm still focusing on certain things with it. So that way, when I can jump back in it in a week or so, then I can do it with maybe more focus and direction.
Right, right. Now, how did you decide you wanted to write a screenplay?
Well, it involves a team. I used to cover high school sports back in the day, and it involves a team I covered that won a state title. And there were some really good characters on that team. And, And the way I told Mark, it's kind of like a Hoosiers meets Bad News Bears type of situation. Uh-huh. So I felt like there were some really good characters, know the coach really well. And he was really thought there was something there. Like, you know, I think you're right. And so you start it, you talk to people, and you know, it was a really different process because I'm sure you guys can appreciate this, but like if I went back and looked at the very first draft I wrote compared to now, it's dramatically different. And you have to go study. I was reading scripts online. I even Goodwill Hunting, tons of scripts, watching movies to take notes about how they did things, and then reading, talking to my son again, who was studying this, who's very bright and knowledgeable, and other people. I had another friend who was in the industry, that, you know, to look into them for not just direction, but like, is this something you think it could be molded into that? And it's really difficult. But, you know, as a writer, you know how to write. And I think the biggest thing that you can't be, what I found is you can't be intimidated by a different process. And it's like anything, like if you own a home, you can't be intimidated by changing the lights because it involves wires. Learn how to change it. You know, it's easy. Right. So I think not that this process is easy, but, you know, why can't you write it? You know, I have some writer friends who are trying to adapt books and they're looking for screenwriters. I'm like, well, why don't you just learn how to do it? And it's, again, it doesn't mean you can do it, but it is, I think it's a challenge worth trying because you don't know. And
it's a whole life philosophy. It's like, you know, for years when I was younger, I was afraid to go into a car dealership. Because I didn't know what I was doing. And finally I had a conversation with a friend and he said, well, first of all, you know, you're walking in as if you're covered in blood. They're sharks. They sense it. They see it. They smell it. Yeah. It's all how we approach anything in life.
Yes.
And I'm better in a car dealership now. Yes. Not great, but better.
Yeah. And it is. And I think the key with anything is keep an open mind and be curious about it too. And I say that, and you know, we all have resources around us, and like connecting with Mark has been good for me. And like, we've only talked a little bit about this, but I know there'll be more in the future. And you just, you know, so you just can't be intimidated. And again, there's so many, I can't tell you how many books I've read, or at least passages of books or things online to read. And it's still, I also think, you know, for example, I like to drink wine, right? Not a ton, you know, but I like to drink. I like to learn about wine because wine to me is a constant quest to learn. It's because you can learn about different varieties. You can learn about different wineries. You can taste something different. It brings out something different. It's that constant quest to just for information, knowledge, study, whatever, that I think is the fun part of this. Because if because what if I can do it? And it's like, what if it works? You know, and if it doesn't, what am I out? I'm not out anything. I'm out time, but I'd rather, you know, sometimes it's just good for that quest to improve yourself or whatever, but that it can be done. But, you know, so I don't know. I found it to be the difficult process is, and I don't mean to keep rambling on it, but the difficult process has been that when you write as a reporter, I am used to, I'm a reporter. I'm dealing with facts. I'm dealing with real information. I don't make anything up in my articles. Well, in this, you have to balance what you want to be true to this story, which actually happened, and all these characters are really good, or a lot of these stories are really good. But you also know that if I just write it like this, it's going to be a 5-hour movie, and it's not going to go well because it doesn't. You have to change it for the screen. So you have to adapt to what you're going to put up there. And so that may mean changing things around from this is how it really happened, but this is how it's going to happen here, because I need it to happen here to advance the story and to get to the point sooner, or to show something else at a different point. So there's, you know, so like you end up, I mean, I have the biggest thing I have to do now is go back and cut and tighten and sharpen and focus. But the other thing too, Mark and I talked about this, is you have to really say, what's at stake for all these people? And you really have to sharpen that. And what that helped me do is that, okay, now you go back and you say, who are the main characters and what's at stake? And then once you get that, then you can start to focus it even more. But it's an interesting process because it is very different and you are writing differently, and you have to learn to write dialogue. And I don't even know if I can write it well yet, because I don't know. You know, I'm trying, but it is it's an interesting process. And I think, you know, the other thing too is when you go back and read the script, and you can just, when you're reading the script and you can see the movie and you can feel it, that means, okay, that's really good. So, like, you know, Good Will Hunting, it took them 27 drafts to get it. So you, when you see that as a, for my job, I don't write anything 27 times. I'm going to write it. My editor's going to look at it. I'll write it again. And at most, it's going to be one draft. You know, I'm going to turn it in one time, one revision. With these, it's a constant. And I understand why, because you're constantly thinking about it and you're constantly, you know what, this doesn't work. And then lastly, I remember watching the movie, The Rookie. And because it's a base, you know, this, what I'm trying to do is a baseball movie. This is a baseball movie. And so you're watching that. Well, how did they do the baseball scenes? How did they do this? How did they do that? Well, then you watch the editor's cut afterwards. And what struck me was that I think the writer said that, or one of the writers, the producer said, one of his favorite scenes they had to cut. He goes, it was a great scene. I'm thinking, if he had to cut one of his favorite scenes, nothing should be sacred from mine.
Right.
And that's one of the things we always talk about when I mentor young writers. And listen, I was not there when I started. And I remember the first time I was in the writer's room and the executive producer took my script and ripped out a bunch of pages. And he looked at me and said, don't fall in love with your work, kid. And so I tell that to young writers all the time. Listen, don't fall in love with it. Because you know what? We're not doing King Lear. We're doing television or movies, and we're entertaining, and there's a thousand ways to skin a cat. But until you're Aaron Sorkin or Chuck Lorre or, you know, any of these guys, they can fall in love with their work and they can put anything on they want. Larry David, as an example. Mm-hmm. Boy, what a great season of Curb this year. Oh,
yes.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
And, you know, the other thing, like, to your point, like, I was reading the William Goldman's, The Adventures in the Screen Trade.
Yeah, great
And
book.
What you learn is, like, it is, and it's funny because you read them, like, oh, my God, this is even harder than you think. You know, and I think, like, to Mark's point, like, what I've learned is when you're a writer for what I do, you do, I don't want to say you fall in love with your words, but it is very personal because it comes out and your name is on it. And it's just a different feel, whereas this, there are different goals in mind, and you know that more and more and more people will look at it. And I've had some stories for ESPN where it's been like that, where I've had eight editors may have looked at it. So what I turned in was dramatically different. Now, the end product was good, but it was dramatically different than myself and another writer. We had combined our story, what we had originally turned in. But so the more eyes and hands that get on it, you know it's going to change. So you want the finished product to be good, and that's the goal for anything. And especially like for me in this case, if I'm lucky enough where it goes anywhere, I understand my stature in this. I don't have any stature. I'm with ESPN. If I turn on ESPN, I've got stature there. I don't have it over here. So I need all the help and guidance I can get. And if they say, you know what, it's got to go this way, it's not going anywhere, what am I going to say? No, you know?
You know, to John's credit, though, in his business, what I think in the reporting business is it really comes down to two things. And this was actually the reason, and John, I'm sure you remember this. This was the thing that first attracted me to John and started our friendship. In his business, it generally comes down to subjective and objective reporting. And John was easily one of the most objective reporters I ever read. Factual, opinionated, but he never made it personal. And there were a lot of writers I found covering various NFL teams and including the Redskins that I felt sometimes had personal bends on their reporting. And John, you know, I mean, is that true, John, in terms of in reporting, it really comes down to subjective and objective?
Yes. Well, and I think, you know, and I appreciate you picking up on the fact that my big thing is don't make it personal. You know, once you start going there, then I think people can question your motives behind things. If you leave it to like, here's a situation, here's what I know, and here's what I'm hearing, and this is how I analyze it. But once you start making it personal, I think you lose that. I personally believe you lose that ability. And I feel like one of the reasons why I cover what has been at times chaotic, dysfunctional franchise.
Right.
And I covered it for a long time. And the reason why I feel like I've been able to do that is because I don't take things personal. If they do something bad, it might be someone who likes to watch good football, it can be frustrating because you haven't always seen that. And you like to, because what you want as a reporter, you want to be relevant. You want people to read you and you want to cover big games. But I don't take things personal. So if there's someone in there that is viewed a certain way, he's not being that way for me. You know, it's not about me. I'm the conduit for the fans. I owe it to them. I owe it to the readers to not come at it with, you know, I don't want them to know what I really think of something or, you know, if they detect like, oh, you just, and I know some reporters, they clearly have a personal edge against whatever team they cover and it comes out. And so they report some things like people don't believe them because like, well, you just dislike this team. So
what those writers do gain is they gain a very large troll following.
Yes, no doubt. And listen, there's, you know, I think my approach is a slower approach to rise. So I think because you're not doing it to sensationalize. And like I could take these crazy takes. I just don't want to because it's not my personality. But I also don't think it's my job. I mean, I want to tell people as much of the truth as I possibly can get. And that's so I think when if the story involves somebody's personal behavior and it's impacting the franchise, impacting their game, et cetera, that becomes different because that affects the play, that affects the product. But if it's just that, well, this guy's a jerk and I don't like him, so therefore I'm going to rip him for any move they make. Well, that I think you're not doing your job.
Right. And you mentioned not making it personal. And I think that actually plays well into the being a film and television, a screenwriter because of the fact, I mean, it's different in the sense of the writing, obviously your characters have a perspective. There's a definite POV there. And obviously they're not real people, generally speaking, unless you're writing an autobiography or something, you know, like you're writing Vice or something like that. So you're not really, you're causing an issue in that sense. But in terms of as a writer, it's also valuable to not make it personal because when you send out your material and it gets passed on, I know a lot of writers take that personal because it's a personal thing, yeah, writing and putting your work out there. But when you make it personal and it's not, they're passing on it for whatever reason. It just wasn't their thing or, you know, they don't have a slate for it or they already have an action comedy in development or a sports film in development. You learn not to make it personal. Go ahead.
Well, I'm just going to say, you know, long before I started writing, when I first moved out to LA, I was an actor and I went out on auditions. And those I really took personal because it's my face, it's my voice, it's the way I'm conveying the material. And those, that was one of the reasons why I started segueing away from it. And then in writing, not as much, especially after so many years of working and having success, you get to a point where you just go, so, you know, my sample wasn't their cup of tea, but I know I do this very well. And there's a very, very small percentage of people in the Writers Guild that, you know, have had a 30-year career. So you get to a place where it still hurts, but it's far less personal than when it's really your face out there. And I have so much empathy for, young actors. And I think we talked about this the last time I did the show, Kevin, that I try and go overboard when I audition actors, especially kids.
Yeah.
Because, boy, you know, you're a 12-year-old kid. You come in, audition for a room full of writer producers and then you walk out and you don't hear from us, boy, you feel horrible.
Yeah.
And you know, it's funny because I think what helps me too with that is that as I said earlier, my son is trying to become an actor. And so he's gone on auditions and he has so far been really good about not taking it personal. He always talks about, well, I wasn't what they were looking for, whether it's my look or this. I would think that after a while, it's hard not to feel a certain way because, you know, you want to be taken seriously. I think the more you read and research, the more you realize, like one of my favorite shows is The Office. When you read the stories of those people and like Jenna Fischer in particular, and the things that they go through, and it's like, okay, you kind of get a feel for what this industry is like. Now I haven't gone through it, so it's different for me, but I'm, you know, when you're trying to approach like, okay, this is different and you have to take this approach. And part of I read some of those books because I wanted to know what my son was going to go through, but also to know, like, well, what's this industry really like? Because I know my industry and my, you know, my story. Like, if I have a story that I get turned into an editor that gets twisted around, well, it bothers me from a competitive standpoint. Because, like what Mark was saying, I know what I've been in this industry a long time. I've reached a pretty high point being at ESPN. So you feel like, okay, I know I've earned the right to be here. But when they twist, when they fix your stories, my first thought is, you know, I don't want to cuss, so I'll just say shoot. you know, but you know, why couldn't I have gotten it right the first time? And that's what bothers me more so, because like I know if they're fixing every story, I take it personal. If it's one every once in a while, it's like I didn't do my job. I'm more annoyed with myself for not doing the job and giving them the part they want than feeling bad that they corrected it. That like, oh, maybe I'm not, you know, not, you know, it doesn't affect my confidence. It's more getting kind of PO'd that, as you know, someone who you want to turn in the right thing, the best thing every time, but it's really not like, I don't take it as a commentary on me unless they're telling me you just can't write. Then I would take it personally.
Yeah.
Fortunately, that isn't the case. I haven't been told that, but you know, so you do learn how to understand that when you're younger, it's a lot harder because you don't know who you are yet in this business. You think you know, but you don't know. And so it's like it takes a long time to build up a level of confidence and self-esteem in the business. And I'll tell you, like, I'm sure even with Mark, like, even still in this industry for me, you go through questions all the time about, well, am I doing the right thing? But it's usually about approach. Am I taking the right approach? Am I doing the right things to get to not just get ahead, but to stay ahead? Am I making the extra phone call? Am I getting up early enough to research this? Am I talking to the right people? If not, who can I talk to? Those are the things that I always question myself on.
And what you're saying, John, the approach, there was a point in my life when I was a little older where I started realizing I equated show business with high school and asking girls out. And at first, it was always personal. And then you start going, what's my approach? Who am I asking out? How am I doing it? And that's show business too. It really is. Show business is actually probably more high school than high school. There is so much pettiness and so much, elitist behavior and inner circle and who you in with and who you not in with. So, you know, I think that's a good way for young people to look at it as they go through these things and they get turned down for gigs and, you know, workshops and fellowships at the studios, all that. Just go, high school, wrong girl, wrong guy. Next.
Yeah.
Right. And I think it's easy to think that there's this big machine with a system designed to equally compare every submission, whether it's a screenplay or an actor that comes in, and you're judged based on the same metrics. And if you are not selected, then it's a testament, or it's a flaw in you or your work or
you
something
mean,
like
hey,
that.
Kevin, you mean hand in scripts without a cover page?
Right. Exactly.
We talked about that forever.
Right.
Let agents assign a number to a script, send it in. Let the reader have no idea who they're reading.
Right. And I can tell you, having been a production company reader and having been an assistant at an agency and having assisted a casting director, I can tell you that's absolutely not the case. It could be, like you said, something as simple as, well, this script is good, but this is a name writer, so we're going to hire that person, regardless of anything else there. Or, you know, in casting, it's like, well, you know, the lead actor we're selecting has brown hair, and we want the actor opposite them to have blonde hair, even though we really like that other kid who had brown hair, but he doesn't have, you know, he's got dark hair, so we're going to pick the light-haired kid.
Funny, I just shared this story yesterday with somebody.
Yeah.
When I was executive producing the show So Little Time, uh-huh, the Olsen twins. There was an actress that came in named Amy Davidson. I was adding a girl to the cast who was going to work at the coffee hangout as a quirky, funny, you know, waitress. And this girl came in and I fell in love with her. She was exactly what I wanted in the part. She was funny. She was compelling, all that. She was a blonde.
Mm.
And the girls, Mary-Kate and Ashley, had enough control that whoever I hired and added to the cast, they had a meet. Mm-hmm. And I knew how the girls were, that there was no way they were going to want another blonde. So I said to Amy, I said, you're going to come back tomorrow. She goes, great. I go, I need you. If it's okay with your parents, I need you. I want you to dye your hair red.
Hmm.
And she did. And she got the part. And to this day, she's still a redhead. And after she did our show, she went on and she did the show with John Ritter and Kaylee Dwaku, Eight Simple Rules to Dating My Daughter. So, but to your point of her talent was her talent, but it was not going to happen based on blonde. So I advised her to become a redhead.
Right. And speaking to what John was saying about always sort of being proactive and talking to the right people and constantly putting yourself out there and things, I sort of relay it since we're talking about actors. When I was in film school at USC, I remember it, even though I produced a lot of student films at USC. And I remember getting this actor's headshot so many times that I absolutely remember who she is. Her name is Constance Zimmer. And a lot of people didn't cast her. You know, she's a fantastic. I remember seeing her come in and fighting for her with the directors, but the director went someone that was more ingenue-like, you know, if you know what I mean. And not that those actors ever, you know, were bad, but Constance is a fantastic actor. But she would send her headshot, and to every single film, student film, like everyone I knew had stacks, like five or six of her headshots, and they were everywhere. And, you know, I don't know how many USC student films she booked, but I know I brought her in a number of times and, you know, tried to get directors to cast her and never was able to. But afterwards, she has gone on to do a ton of work. She was obviously probably best known for being Dana Gordon on Entourage, but has done, you know, co-starring or recurring in Grey's Anatomy and The Newsroom and Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and tons of different series because she's such a great actor and she continually just hustles like no one I'd ever seen in film school. And this was, again, student film. She was just hustling. And so, you know, to your son, I would say just keep getting out there. And, you know, if you believe in yourself and you continually hustle, you can make it. Because she's a test. Granted, she's brilliantly talented. But, you know, half of it is the work. I didn't, you know, get as many headshots from any other actor. I don't, like, again, years later, I'm like, she looks super familiar when she was starting to do guest roles in things. I'm like, I know. And again, she was the one who'd sent in so many headshots to every student film at USC. So, you know, a lot of it is persistence and, you know, being proactive.
Well, and that's even for my son, you know, he ended up going to Temple Film School and he would have liked to have gone to USC, but it was going to be a difficult one. And he got into Emerson mm-hmm. too, but Emerson is very, very costly and he got a good scholarship to Temple. Temple has a good program. Mm-hmm. But the thing I always stress to him is like, you can, and obviously you guys know the industry better as far as where you go and how it matters. But I said, anything in life, it's always going to be about your drive and your persistence. That's what's going to make it, whether you could go to, you know, you can read a story again. I go back to Good Will Hunting because I love that script, but what those guys did to get that movie made and how Ben Affleck and Matt Damon were always going down to New York to get this stuff made, to audition and audition, audition. It's the drive. They have talent, but it was the drive. And so if you have that, I think in anything, you can do it. And if you sit there and say, well, I can't do it because this person, you know, well, they probably grew up in this and I didn't have that. Well, BS, they had something internally. You realize as you get older that the people who make it, they got there. And very few people are so naturally gifted that they don't have to have the same kind of drive. Usually it comes down to that. And there are gifts, and people have different gifts. But if your drive is one of them, you're going to be okay.
Right. There's a lot more people working who are talented, but hustle and you know, give everything they have to it, than there are super gifted people who kind of just fell into it.
Right.
What other resources, again, starting, you know, your journey a few years back, what other resources did you find helpful in terms of your learning screenwriting, John?
Just reading a lot of books. I'd go to the library and check out a bunch of different books. And I mean, off the top of my head, I'm trying to remember, there's some, whatever the most popular ones are, those are the ones I would typically read, just to see, how do you structure things? How does the plot have to go? And, you know, act one, act two, act three, and, you know, the seven, seven, I guess, acts within the movie or whatever. And then I talked to a lot of people. I had a friend who I went to Ohio State, who was in the industry, and he and I would talk, and he kind of encouraged me to do this because he felt like there was something there. And so I would talk to him a lot, and I would send him some stuff, say, hey, can you take a look at this? Am I taking the right approach? Am I doing the right things? And so that was a lot of it, but reading is a lot of it. There's so much information out there, thanks to the internet and whatever, that it's like, it's hard not to find whatever it is you want to do. If I want to learn how to change brakes on my car, I can go to Google, I can go to YouTube and learn how to do it. So you can find any information you want out there. So that's where the biggest resource. And then again, my son going into it, you know, I find him very, very bright. I mean, you know, he's my son, so I'm going to say that, but I also think he is. And so he has something to add. So don't be afraid to find anything you think can help you. And if my son can help me, I'm going to talk to him because he has more knowledge about it than I do because he's in it. I'm trying to learn it, and I'm a different writer. So, you know, so there's a lot of things. It's just, there's so many resources for, you have more than you realize at your disposal. And, you know, and I mean, you know, so I think there's more that I have that I know I can tap into. And so I think that's always a nice thing to have. But it's like, get to a certain point and then use this, get to this point and then use that. And so I think it's just about, again, just keep pushing to learn more.
Hey, right. John?
Yes.
I don't want to be doing your job, but did you see the breaking news?
Yeah, I've been taking care of it. Don't worry.
Oh, my gosh. That's all they got. Sorry, Kevin. Let John announce it. It's his team.
No, they traded one of their corners to Seattle. So that was something we've been waiting for. So that I've been typing a couple of things up as we speak. So sometimes you learn how to... You do a couple of things at once.
You're right. Your job only does not end. You're doing a podcast interview, and all of a sudden, yeah, in the middle of it.
It does not end, ever. Right. Yeah.
And yet, me, the comedy writer, actually for a second thought I was breaking the story.
No.
Well, speaking of sports, and Mark, you recently put out on Twitter, which I'll link to this so that people don't have to dig for it, but a link to your list of 15 sports films that you love. And I'm going to name them off really quickly, and then we can discuss, because I already just picked out, just in our conversation now, one that's not in the list that I think should be. But then again, like we were talking about before we went on, about the Mount Rushmore, like which one do you take out to replace it with? Anyway, so you have in... no particular order, as I was given instruction by Mark to say. Number one, Slapshot, great film. Number two, Bull Durham, obviously. Three, Field of Dreams. Four, Raging Bull. Five, Bang the Drum Slowly. Six, The Sandlot. Seven, Tin Cup. Eight, Rocky. Nine, Hoosiers. 10, A League of Their Own. 11, Rudy. 12, Major League. 13, Caddyshack. 14, North Dallas 40. And 15, Hoop Dreams, even though it's a documentary, but a great film. I don't know, John, maybe before we let Mark defend his choices, maybe, John, do you have additions to that or anything that you feel should be added to that list that was not on there?
The couple of them that I'm trying to remember a miracle. The Olympic hockey team. To me is one. And I just watched that recently, and it sucks you in so much to the point where we had to pause it, like with about a minute and a half left in the game against the Soviet Union. Like I was going nuts. Like, what are we doing? You can let go. You want the build up. You want the emotion. But that's so. Like, and I also like to coach kids too. So I like movies that, where you can see the motivational techniques, whether it's Hoosiers or Miracle, whatever. So, you know, I that was one of the ones that I would put on there as well.
Mm-hmm. And I would say, Mark, what about The Bad News Bears, which I It's not.
That was the other one I was going to say. Yes.
Yeah.
The Natural.
The original, of course, not the Billy Bob.
Original. No. Yeah, of course. The Natural. Robert Redford. And
great movie.
Maybe Moneyball. I love that film. I think, is it too new to be on a list? You know, like I Tonya, maybe too new. The Blind Side.
Blind Side was great. I actually met the young man who played Michael Orr, the actor. I met him about 3-4 months ago.
Mm-hmm. My problem with the Blind Side is the way they had the high school coach was too much of a fool. I mean, it was they dumped him down so much. I'm like, I kind of had a problem with that. I liked the movie. I really liked the movie, but I always had a problem with how they portrayed the high school coach. It was not in line with how it really was. And I know why they wanted to kind of make the mom kind of get out there and show this is what you got to do, but it's still, I would have liked a little bit better portrayal of that one. But I liked the movie a lot.
And I'll tell you, John and Kevin, what's not on here that bothers me, and I ran out of characters. I could have done another thread, whatever, but...
Sure.
There's a TV movie called Brian's Song.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that, yeah.
And then there's another that probably doesn't hold up, another TV movie. And I know John will remember, and Kevin, if you do, you know, Big Ops, Something for Joey.
Oh, I thought you were going to say White Shadow.
Oh, White Shadow was a series.
Yeah, So I do remember Something for Joey, and I forget the plot itself, though, to be honest. But
there was a Penn State running back named John Capoletti.
Oh, that's right, yes. Absolutely.
And it was now about his younger brother who was dying of cancer during his Heisman year.
Right.
That's right. I do remember that. That was the other one. Then, if you want to go with that, the Ernie Davis All-American story. That's another one. I think. Did you mention the Lou Gehrig story?
No. Pride of the Yankees is not on here, which is phenomenal.
Yeah.
That's got the most iconic speech in sports. There's also another kind of fun comedy that's not on here. Robin Williams and I believe Kurt Russell, The Best of Times.
Oh, yeah.
But not Wildcats.
Yeah, no,
what'd you say, Wildcats?
Yeah.
What was the other one? It was Unnecessary Roughness with Kathy Ireland. You had Wildcat with Goldie Hawn.
Goldie Hawn and Sinbad. But I want to focus on this list for a second because, you know, Kevin, you talk about the Mount Rushmore, and I want to try and cherry pick 4 or 5 and try and justify why. I'm going to grab Field of Dreams first.
Okay.
And I think that baseball is the most, you know, when you think of Americana, you think of baseball. I have 2 sons and it's a cliche, but there's so much emotional truth to it. That catch you have with your kid. When he's at the right age where he can actually catch the ball and throw it back to you, and it's 15 minutes back and forth. And those moments, that catch with your kid, truly is, it's a special, special thing. So Field of Dreams to me, you know, a story that, you know, from the book that had so much fantasy to it, but yet at its core had this beautiful father-son story and how baseball was, you know, the constant and the driving force in the narrative. So that, to me, would absolutely be on a top 4. I would also, I'm going to go baseball. Gee, you know what? I may end up going 3 baseball here.
Wow.
Because I'm actually going to put A League of Their Own up there as one of my favorite movies.
I love that movie.
Yeah, I agree.
I'm glad you do, John, and Kevin also. Because, again, the world we live in, you know, feminism is real and right, and equality is everything and a must. And to show these women playing baseball and loving the game just like our sons, I think it's pretty special. And then to, you know, Tom Hanks's character, And of course, the iconic There's No Crying in Baseball. Mm-hmm. So as a kind of sleeper pick, I would probably have A League of Their Own up there. John Lovitz as the agent was fantastic.
He was great. Well, you know, and the funny thing is, like, I like movies that are not centered around World War II, but take place during that time, because it's such an intriguing time in our country's history with what was going on and what women had to, how they were helping out during the war. And it wasn't always about, you know, being the shops, the factories. It was also about providing the distraction as well. And I know there was baseball going on, but that was also a distraction for a lot of people. But I love, like, you know, Marla Hooch and just the little things, like they're introducing all the players and they have the shot, they have a close-up shot of every player, and it gets to Marla and she's like 100 feet away from the camera. Just, it's just, you know, but I love that movie. Everything, it's just the way of life at the time, the little scene, the one scene with the African-American ladies who show up and, you know, they're off the side, and it makes a point without, you know, it makes a subtle point, and, you know, and a good one. So I think there was a lot of good things within that movie that I really enjoyed. And just, and also the locker room scene when you find out that somebody's husband died.
Yes.
And the note was handed, and the build up to it, the slow walk, he's got the slow gait, and you know, the anger is like, the bumbling guy who's delivering the message, and then Tom Hanks' slow gait, and you know, as a viewer, you don't know whose husband it was. Like in some movies, you're gonna, well, clearly it's not gonna be her husband because whatever, but you don't know that at that time in that movie, because World War II was so random that it just played it up well. So that's one of those movies that if it's on, I want to watch it.
Mm-hmm. And you know, you mentioned the race with the team of black women, all that. And it made me think of two movies that I left off of here. Jackie Robinson, Jackie, and Ali, Smith one.
Mm-hmm.
Two great movies, like just absolutely fabulous. Great message and great, you know, great story, et cetera. You know, back to here, I, for some reason, as being a writer that, you know, 80%, 90% of my career, guys, has been kid stuff, writing, you know, kid shows, family shows, whatever you want to call them, but writing, you know, 12, 13, 14-year-old protagonists. And that's why I would have the original Sandlot up there.
Oh, I see.
Love Sandlot.
Yeah, it's classic.
I love that movie. Think it's spectacular. And of course, you know, if I remember, I think Dennis Leary played the dad, or was that in Sandlot 2?
That was Sandlot. That was the original, was him. And you know, because that one takes you back to when you're a kid, because that's what we used to do. And that's why I always enjoyed that. Like, you know, in Caddyshack, I consider a sports movie, but I consider that a comedy more than a sports movie, from my own take. And then the other, did you bring up Remember the Titans?
No.
It's absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, and, you know, it's funny because, like, I got to know people, the Alexandria community, I got to know pretty well. I used to coach basketball over there. But the T.C. Williams High School was part of one of the teams I covered when I was a press reporter. And so, you know, you meet some people, they always talk about that team. Long before the movie came out, you always knew about that team. The only issue I had with that one was, you know, that team was so good that I don't think they ever had any close games. But the way they had to win that game, it's like you have to suspend belief that you're going to win in a trick play like that in that setting. But by that point, you're so into the movie.
Caught up in it, yeah.
Yeah, you're so caught up in it that it's like, I'm going to give them that. If there's sometimes if you do some of that stuff early on, it's like, I have a hard time with it, you know, but that one, by that point, okay, I'm okay with that. I know it didn't happen that way. I know it wouldn't happen that way. 90% chance, but I'm okay with it. Cause it got to the ending that you needed it to get to.
Well, it was like the end of The Natural, home run up in the
life. Yeah.
And you know, like, you know, but I don't know. I just, that was, you know, I liked Denzel Washington. So whatever he's in, and
absolutely,
I was like him. And I just like the way, cause you learn, like, how do you portray subtle messages? And for me, that's one of the things I go back and look for. How do you portray this? And it's always, you know, as you guys know, it's show, don't tell. Mm-hmm. How do you show this? How do you show, like, it can just be a jet. It could be a casual look of the eyes that's, that, okay, I know what you're thinking because I saw your face.
Right,
you don't have
exactly.
to say anything. It's just, so like, you see that in that movie, and you see, you can show a couple scenes to show somebody's growth. It's very subtle, but you can see it. And it always takes, you know, so that's what, those are some of the things I like with that movie too.
And that's great storytelling too, when you can just advance the story with a look. You know, I just want to, for me, wrap up my list on here. And I guess having grown up in Canada and playing hockey, and Kevin, you know, I've shared the Gretzky story with you before.
How many goals was it?
One or two?
No, I think it was a few more than that.
Three, four, maybe? All right, 11, 11.
Yeah.
You scored 11 goals. Leave me alone.
You ran out of fingers.
Anyway, the point is Slapshot. I just watched it again the other day. That's what quarantine, self-isolation, social distancing, whatever you want to call it, will do. And I just wanted to see two movies that I love that I haven't seen in a long time. I'm a huge John Hughes fan. John Hughes is probably one of my inspirations. So I watched Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
Great film.
Which is just great. And then I watched Slapshot. And for a movie, 1977 it was made.
Can't believe that.
That's unbelievable to think about.
Yeah.
And it held up, and it was funny, and it captured, you know, the low minor leagues and, you know, back in those days, because we used to go, me and my brother, when we were 10, 11, 12 years old, you know, in Montreal, we'd go to these small arenas and watch, you know, either minor league teams play or the low juniors. And this is in the 70s. And I can't tell you, probably three out of every four games we went to, there was a brawl in the pregame warmups. So to those who don't know and believe Slapshot was in complete 100% hyperbole, no. That's what went on back then. Nobody wore helmets, and people fought, and they fought because the hockey chicks who hung out, they liked guys with cuts and scars and no teeth. And it really, that's the way the hockey was back then.
Now they just wear helmets.
They wear helmets and shields, and if you fight and punch, you've cracked your knuckles.
That's a great movie. It's funny because that's not a movie that's on enough to go always like, oh yeah, I'm going to go watch that or tape it or whatever. And it's a little, you know, I wish they would run it, especially now. I wish they'd run every movie, because anything sports related you want to see.
Right.
But you know, that is one that I don't think it's remembered by the people who know it and went through that period, but it's one that I wish they would replay once in a while.
Now, John, here's the big question. Here's the million-dollar question. Is Ace Ventura, Pet Detective, a football movie?
You know, here's a funny thing. I don't know that I've ever seen the whole thing. I've seen parts of it. And, I know I've watched definite parts of it. I'm trying to think if I've seen the whole thing of it. But I guess it's the same way as what's the movie?
Die Hard.
Yeah. Is that a Christmas movie?
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know. I don't like, just because like, to me, like I want sports. Well, I guess, I don't know. It was kind of central. This, you know, I don't know. Maybe it is. I don't know.
Dan Marino was in it.
Yeah, I know. That's what I mean. It's like, it was a key part of it. So it definitely was a key part. So, you know, but I, you know, and like I said, I separate those kind of things from a real sports movie like the Bull Durhams, have moments of humor, but more slice of life humor versus Caddyshack, which is just tremendous. You know, like it's a comedy, but it's about sports, it's a comedy. It makes me laugh. And you don't have to be a sports fan to like it. Whereas I think Bull Durham, you know, movies like that, again, that's one that if it's on, I'm going to watch.
Yeah, because, Bull Durham is special.
Yeah, and like, you know, and I think like that one, if you're not a big baseball fan, you might not get why are they riding these buses? You might not get certain parts of it. And, you know, the funny thing is the only thing I had a problem with that movie was that it was, I think there was a high single, high A team, high class A team. And having Kevin Costner go back down there at that age would be highly, highly unusual. But again, the movie's so good, just like, well, I'm not going to worry about that.
Right.
But didn't, I don't remember because I haven't seen it in a few years, John, wasn't part of why he went down there was
it was
mentor
right. And I could see that if they had said, like, typically in the major, in the, you know this, like in the Major League Baseball, you would do that at double A or maybe even triple A. And where you go down and do that, but you're not sending a guy of his standing in minor league baseball down that far. But again, you know, they made it clear why it was okay. This is your role. And it's typical. It's, you don't see guys getting promoted from class A to the major leagues like that very often. Especially. So there was like, that's why I say like, but once you start talking about that, you kind of ruin the movie. So, you know, you just like, it's a great movie. The parts of it, I don't even care if it's double A, single A, triple A, everything else is so legit and so believable. And actually the writer played, I think he played minor league baseball. So it's so well done because it does feel.
Wasn't it Ron Shelton?
Yeah, it was Ron Shelton. And I think he did play. I read that he played. And you can tell because it's like the chatter and like, you know, they have the gathering at the mound where they're talking about the candle holders. I would guarantee like some of those actually happen. You know, because like that's people always think you're going out there's like, oh, they must be talking about this great strategy. And half the time it's like, it's probably not. I mean, Tommy Lasorda, you read some stuff like his stories from when he was the Dodgers manager and the stuff that he talked about with the umpires and all that. It's like half the time it's not about what you think.
Yeah. Right. Well, it's also like, the you know, the great book, Ball Four, Jim Bouton.
Yes. Yeah,
I mean, that's also the reason I think why they say write what you know. And also a lot of showrunners like writers who have lived a life because coming out of college, you don't have the same experience. You haven't had, you know, the same interactions, the same life's experience that somebody who has played minor league baseball. So he's writing a minor league baseball story and the authenticity is not there. It's not the same. You know, just because you've seen a bunch of movies does not necessarily mean you have the same, you know, breadth of experience as people who have actually lived through that stuff. So,
yeah. And I think that's true. You know, it's funny because even in my industry, those experiences will be true because it helps you relate to the person you're talking to, which helps you get better information and quotes and whatever. So, you know, whereas if I'm, you know, a young reporter, you may not know how to establish that, even though you might be the same age as some of these guys, there's just, it can be different. So once you go through, like for me, the way I have to relate to players, well, I'm old enough to be their dad and, you know, definitely old enough to be their dad, but you still like, well, how do you relate to these guys? They're coming from different, you know, they're different situations, all of them. So how do you, well, you relate by getting to know the sport more and talking to them at a different level about what they do. And that opens the door to other things, but it does, but that goes to my life experience. And just like with, you know, if you're writing a screenplay, you are going to draw upon some of your own life experience. And the more you live, the more you can draw upon.
Right.
For sure.
And before I get your Mount Rushmore of sports movies, John, I just wanted to say to Mark, there's a couple, I noticed that, now looking at your list, most of them are 90s to earlier. And I wanted to throw a couple out that I thought might make the list, but they're more recent that I thought maybe you'd forgotten. Movies like The Wrestler, which was an amazing film.
Wrestler's great.
Yeah.
Great. Very disturbing. Very disturbing.
Sure, but I think a really powerful film, Million Dollar Baby.
Oh, wait. Sorry, I was thinking of the Foxcatcher.
Oh, no.
The Wrestler. Yeah, Mickey Rourke.
Yeah.
Great movie.
Yeah.
No, Foxcatcher was the disturbing one.
Right. Well, I think, you know, the Wrestler thing. when Mickey Rourke cuts it himself, you know, and things like that, and, you know, the things he puts his body through. It is sort of disturbing, but it's just a really powerful
film. It was a great movie. Fantastic movie.
And a lot of people associate Friday Night Lights, even though it was a book, it was a film as well, which I think was really, really good. But people associate it with a TV series, which is also good, but it's definitely, you know, different, much different than the film, which I thought was fantastic.
Right. Agree.
Those are the ones that I thought.
Probably wouldn't crack my top 20. It's certainly terrific.
Okay, John, you got a your
I don't have like I don't have a I don't have my prepared list, but I would rattle off the movies that, and if I go back to, you know, like going to my childhood to now, like Rocky would be on there.
Mm-hmm.
And Bad News Bears would be on there, because that's such a big part of childhood that everybody wanted to be Tanner. You know, you're this, you're
yeah.
this guy, you're Kelly or whatever. You know, so that was another one. I did like Sandlot a lot. But then, you know, my top ones would be definitely Hoosiers, Bull Durham. I love Miracle. League of Their Own is an absolute must for me. Like I said, if it's on, all those three movies, Hoosiers, because Hoosiers to me appeals to many, many things for me. Like, I love coaching basketball, and I coach a lot of youth basketball for many, many years at different levels. So I love that process of seeing how you bring a team together. And so that's part of it. And then there's the backdrop of the stories, and there are other things in some of those player stories that I can relate to. So there's, you know, and then it's just like, I love the atmosphere of a gym and all that. So it all was great. And the underdog story, and it is based on a true story. So there, you know, 90% of it was made up, but it doesn't matter. It just, it gets me every time. And some of those, like the scene in the locker room before they're going out there, you know, let's win it for all the small schools that never had a chance. Like, I get chills just even saying that,
mm-hmm.
because it's just like, it's so cool. And it's like, you know, there's, it's great to be, you know, sometimes in life, it's fun to be the underdog, do the things that nobody says you can. I love that movie. And, you know, Bull Durham, because of, like we talked about, just to me, just so realistic and such a great portrayal and of the industry, but in a very fun way. So those, like, I'm trying to think of some of the other movies. You know, Major League is a favorite of mine because I grew up in Cleveland. So that movie came out. Here's how bad it was in Cleveland for a sports fan. People, fans in Cleveland cheered the movie because it was the only time we'd seen the Indians win. So like, you're in the movie theater seeing this. I'm with my girlfriend, not my wife. You clapped at the end because, like, oh, my God, I finally saw the Indians win. And it didn't matter that it was in a movie. So
right.
That's why that movie resonated so much. And plus, again, I'm from there. And my wife, actually, fun fact, was in that movie. Because
oh.
there was one shot. There was one shot in that movie where the movie was actually filmed in Milwaukee. Or the stadium was Milwaukee Stadium. But there was one shot from Cleveland, the old Cleveland Stadium, big cavernous building. And in that shot, it was a full house. There were 70-some thousand people there. My wife was in the crowd. So technically, she was in the movie. And I love Field of Dreams too. That was another one too I liked too.
Yeah. No, I mean, they're all, it's so hard to pick just from, I mean, Mark's list was 15. It could have been 30, and you still probably wouldn't be able to
either.
Argue like what you could take off that, you know, doesn't qualify. Oh, and I would throw in, you know, depending on what area you grew up in, but, you know, like the Sandlot, but also like Cool Runnings, I think, was a great film that, you know, I think gets forgotten. Whenever that's on, I have to watch it for whatever reason. I love that film.
Yeah, I love John Candy.
Yeah, he's amazing. And, you know, anyway, no one mentioned Dodgeball, but we'll put that aside for now.
Yeah, I actually like it.
No, I love it. It's a great film. I mean, as a, you know, a real true sports movie, I don't know, but it's a great comedy. It's a great film.
I believe one of the highest grossing sports films of all time was Space Jam.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I didn't know that, but I mean, it makes sense, I suppose.
Well, how about, you know what? We haven't even, did you bring up Cool Runnings?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I'm sorry. I had to get distracted. Some of that story that I was still working on. That was a fun movie too.
Yeah.
So I heard John Candy. I thought, okay, I apologize for blanking out there for a second, but I had
yeah.
to file some more information.
Or even the Mighty Ducks.
Yeah. Oh, Mighty Ducks is great. Actually, Steve Brill, who I know very well, wrote it.
Oh, yeah.
And by the way, made himself a lot of money agreeing to let Eisner use the trademark, the logo, the name, all that for the hockey team.
Oh, you mean it wasn't?
Wow.
I guess who would have thought, I guess, it would be turned into an actual NHL franchise. So I guess that wasn't in the contract. So that's pretty incredible.
Yeah. No, there's so many. Obviously, you know, for the most part, the ones that really connect are the ones that really, have an emotional resonance to them.
Yeah.
Make you feel, you know, have engaged you successfully to the point where you care what happens at the end.
Yeah.
And by the way, you know, one of the geniuses, and it's on my list. I didn't put it on Rushmore, but it could very well be there. And that's Rocky. And
oh, yeah.
He didn't even win in the end, which
right.
is genius.
Yeah. And you're okay with that too, because it really, like I always tell my kids too, I'm a big believer in the journey. The journey is a big thing. And the journey was what mattered for him to get where he was. It wasn't the winning or the losing. It was that journey to get that shot and to go toe-to-toe. What his goal was to get to that shot, and he went toe-to-toe with the guy. It wasn't about, for him, the winning. For Apollo Creed, it had to be about the winning, but for Rocky, it was not about the winning.
Right.
Right.
Initially, at least.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, it changed in Rocky 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 times.
Yes, yes, yes. Yes, yeah.
And lastly, Mark first, maybe, and then I'll throw it to you, John. Any last words to those writers out there who are trying to continue to remain productive during this time, you know, of self-isolation?
Yeah, as I said before, Kevin, my best advice is, regardless of your daily results, do not beat yourself up. Do not be hard on yourself. When you are feeling, write something. If nothing's coming to you, read something, watch something. There's so many things out there that can inspire you, you know, make you reach for something that you always would have thought was out of your reach, like a Jojo Rabbit. If you watch something like that, you may have similar ideas running around in your head, and instead you just feel safer, more comfortable writing, you know, something a little more vanilla.
Right.
So you watch something like a Jojo Rabbit, and then, boy, I watched another incredible movie the other day also, which was one of the most personal, dark, and disturbing films I've ever seen. It was Shia LaBeouf's movie, Honey Boy.
Oh, I haven't seen that.
Unbelievable. So, you know, it's based on his relationship with his father. You know, Shia was a young Disney actor, and apparently his father, who took care of him, was very abusive. Was a failed entertainer himself, who ended up being like a rodeo clown. And the movie, in fact, Shia wrote the script while he was in prison. So
really?
To that end, I'll circle back before you throw it to John.
Yeah.
About being productive during these times. Well, Shia LaBeouf was pretty darn productive when he was in jail. So we are kind of in a jail, but we still have the freedom to get up, go outside, go for a walk. But we can certainly be productive. And the arts are wonderful during times like this because they're everywhere.
Right.
They're everywhere, and you can do it at any time. You're not dependent on going somewhere to have to work. I mean, you know, you don't have to go to Starbucks and sit at the corner and look like you're, you know, you have this writer's life. The writer's life, it does not go there. I mean, it's in your office, pulled away, just grinding. And so, you know, there are, like, my thing is, there are opportunities out there. Find them. You know, become that person that comes out of this with a story to tell that you was like, you know what, I finally had this chance. And you're going to have, like, everybody's got this energy right now, and it's probably a lot of it is negative because you're scared, you're worried about what's going on, your job. You know, maybe somebody got sick. What, you know, that's all of it's understandable. We're all going to have those fears. But if you can channel that into a project that can help take your mind off it and pour that energy into that, you may even base some of this on what you're going through right now. Create a character out of that. What was the movie on Mrs. Miniver during World War II, Casablanca during World War II? We didn't know where the war was going to go. When those movies are made, they came out, you didn't know where the war was going to go.
Right.
But people, during a time of a treacherous period, people still have the ability to go do that and the desire to do that. So there is, you can create that energy, or you can pour that energy into those projects that matters to you. And it is scary and tough. But you know what? it's okay to put that on the page too. Maybe you can start by writing down just in a journal, this sucks, and this is why. And maybe you just start writing and it leads into something else. And maybe you realize, you wake up one day and like, I've got to turn this into something positive. I've got to do it. And that, you know, wake up and get going and just put into it. And it'll help take your mind off all the stuff that's going on, hopefully. I mean, because this sucks right now. I mean, it's really hard. So yeah. Everybody's got that thing. Like, we talk to our kids and everybody's got a story during this period that's going to be like, man, that really sucks. Whether it's somebody who has someone who's dying or went through it, or even just like the high school seniors who don't get their senior year in a sport or in a play or in a music or whatever, in a recital, you know, in a dance recital. So there's the range is pretty vast, but everybody's got it. So you're not alone.
I've been I've been reading stories of both weddings and funerals being done virtually.
Yeah.
Heartbreaking.
It is.
But, you know, it's the truth right now.
It is. And, you know, and it's like I said, it is really hard to put that aside. And it's easy to sit here and say it because we've not, like, you know, usually you can tell your kid, we lost our job. Well, we can get through it because I've done it before. Whatever. Nobody's been through this. So it's hard to know, but if you are home and you are healthy, you can be productive still. You can be. You don't, and so that becomes up to you. And how do you want to come out of this? And is there a story you want to tell? Well, you can tell it. And maybe the emotion just comes out of you because there's so much emotion in you. Channel it. That would be my advice.
Right. No, that's great. And it really shows how you're a sports reporter, but, you know, going back to our conversation about sports films, is that really it's about the human story there, and, you know,
absolutely,
being able to tap into that, and it's everywhere if you really look for it. So that's
absolutely
great.
Absolutely.
So thank you, Mark. Thank you, John. Be sure to
thank
follow
you, Kevin.
Mark.
I'm just going to say thank you, and I'm really glad, you know, John got to join us and we were able to kind of merge the two worlds.
This was a lot of fun for me. I appreciate you having me on.
No, it's been a pleasure. Be sure to follow Mark on Twitter. It's at BlutmanMark. John, what's your Twitter?
John_Kein, KEIM. And if you really like listening to me, I have a podcast called the John Kein Report. So, but it's about the Redskins. And so if you're a Redskins fan listening to it, you'll enjoy it. I had a lot of different guests on. And sometimes we talk about more than just the Redskins, sometimes about food. Last year, the Redskins were really bad, as people who follow the NFL know. Well, every week I had a chef on and we'd have a 10-minute segment talking about food.
Oh, that's
you have to be creative. That's what I mean. You have to be creative. Like, why should people listen? You want me to talk about how bad the Redskins are every week? So bring something on that's like not about the Redskins. Enjoy it. Life is good. You can still have fun with it.
Right, right. No, that's great.
Awesome.
So definitely check out John's podcast. It's about John Kein Report. And to all the writers listening, remember, you're not alone. We're all in this together. So stay safe, be well, and we'll see you tomorrow.